Basiaga Shangana beat. Top Shangani family sing. Job. Sing. Ho. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Drop your heart. Yoga. Amanla on CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto. Amanla is produced by GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa, and is brought to you every Saturday from 11 to 11:30. And this special edition today will be focused on African Liberation Day, which, as you might know, has been celebrated on Wednesday, May the 25th, across the African continent and also in the Black diaspora. But here in Toronto, we're going to have our special commemoration today. But this special African Liberation Day of this year is happening in a specific context, that is defined by a situation where Africa is confronted with the renewed twin threats of neoliberal globalization and militarization. Working in collusion with comprador elites, Western powers, notably the G8, have conceived a neoliberal economic blueprint under the auspices of the so-called New Partnership for African Development, called also known as NIPAD, which is nothing less than an elite-driven process seeking to further integrate Africa into an unjust world capitalist system that has contributed to economic collapse and mass impoverishment throughout the African continent. Under this plan called NIPAD, African people in the continent have been subjected to further trade liberalization, more privatization of public utilities, public sector cutbacks, and further reduction in access to essential services like healthcare, clean and safe water, or education. Pan-Africanists, however, in this specific context, have to fight to dismantle NIPAD and pursue an alternative people-oriented development based on Pan-African principle and one that is rooted in the culture and history of peoples of Africa and the diaspora. In this new scramble for Africa, the United States has moved to counter China's ascendancy in the continent by establishing the United States Africa Command, also known as AFRICOM. AFRICOM's strategy is to secure unfettered access to Africa's vital resources, in particular African oil. Establishment of bases from which to monitor, plan and conduct United States hegemonic wars, and the requirement to monitor and counter the Chinese strategy if necessary. In one word, we can say that AFRICOM envisions the militarization of the African continent to facilitate the upward expansion of U.S. geopolitical sphere in the region. This, of course, poses a serious threat to regional security, and the African masses must rise up to confront AFRICOM's militarization agenda. We can say that in response to this neoliberalism and militarization, African masses have initiated important struggles critical to the survival of its people. Resistance has emerged in various fronts, from general strike in South Africa, militancy in the Niger Delta in Nigeria, to ongoing revolutions in the North African region. Since the people are the foundation of the revolution, the global Pan-African community must, in this context, mobilize behind these struggles. This, of course, requires mass organization, unity of the people, and the determination to bring imperialism to its knees. Today, the African Liberation event that GRILA will be organizing will be held on at the different booklets, which is located at the corner of Blue and Bartos, And this event will start at 5 p.m. today, and everybody is invited to attend. And we're going to be, during this event, try to further explore these two main topics, meaning the neoliberalism and militarization, and also to analyze the critical role women of African descent have played historically in opposing similar strategies that have been maintaining under control Africa and its diaspora under the shackles of slavery, and then after under colonial domination, and now into a neoliberal neo-colonialism. With the recent wave of popular revolt going on throughout the North Africa and also in the southern part of the continent and in the Middle East, this signaled the beginning of a new era where young people, who this time are using new communication tools made possible by internet and related applications, have to once again take back center stage in the struggle to free Africa from the yoke of imperialism. We're going to take a short musical break. And when we come back, I have a special guest today, Carlson Abdu, who is in the studio with me. And we're going to be looking at some of the implications of social medias in relation to the wave of struggles and revolution and revolts happening across Africa today. So we'll take a short musical break. We'll come back in a short minute.
Wa wele dawle ni jabaso You are listening to Amanla on CKLN 88.1 FM. And Amanla today is specifically dedicated to African Liberation Day, which is a historical day that was declared to be a major event across Africa and in the diaspora. It was celebrated the first time in 1958 in Ghana after a conference that was held in that country and that was convened by the late Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Africa Liberation Day came out from that conference in 1958, and the conference was attended by the time by a few African countries that were independent at the time, and it was meant to celebrate the processes that have led to this independence movement, but also to reflect on new ways to carry the struggle a little bit deeper, further into the process of emancipation. Since the beginning of this year, several major events have occurred in Africa within a particular global context. Africa has long endured unfavorable integration into the global system. Over the last couple of decades, the continent has suffered the ravages of neoliberal austerity measures, the pillaging of its resources, and the logic of privatization of war. Today, more than ever, Africa sits at a crossroads with the failure of the neoliberal model, the crisis of capitalism, and the collapse of the neocolonial model of growth. Post-independent states have managed the crisis over the last few decades with a constantly shrinking sovereignty induced by globalization. The comprador models of countries like Ivory Coast, Tunisia, Egypt, and Burkina Faso, cited below, are in decline and in the grips of wheeler-dealer hanksterism. The local autocracies, emboldened by outrageous enrichment and the region of arbitrariness and impunity, respond with repression to the legitimate and increasingly desperate demand of their people. It's within this context that we notice a lot of wave of revolts happening in the last couple of months across Africa, with a more pronounced in North Africa, in countries like in Tunisia and Egypt, but also in countries like Gabon, in Ivory Coast, and in a lot of other countries. People are on the move trying to challenge the political leadership that have been maintaining these countries under domination and not moving further with the promises of deeper emancipation and more of a political freedom. So I have Carlson who is in the office here with me, and we're going to be just talking about this new wave of revolt across Africa. And welcome to the CEO, Carlson.
Thank you very much, Ahmed. First of all, I'll just start by explaining what social media is. These are public engagement tools like Twitter. Sorry. These are public engagement tools like Twitter and Facebook, LinkedIn, and many more that allow us to socialize with friends, share thoughts and information with our networks, and participate in social, political campaigns, among many other things. So when I was given this assignment, the first thing that I thought about was what happened in Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and the Middle East, a social media revolution. And I actually don't think so. And the reason why I don't think so is because revolutions have been happening way before all of these tools were available. So in that case, I think people were already very frustrated by the conditions that existed within their countries and decided that they wanted to make a difference in their lives. And some of these problems were brought about because they have totalitarian kind of regimes, which are obviously propped by the Western governments, unfortunately. They also live in a lot of poverty, and so they have very little income. And also the global economic crisis and how it's affected developing countries is also very critical. And based on those three things, I think it was just way too much, and I think it was somewhat of a tipping point for many African countries to actually, people to want to change and make a difference in their lives. So it had nothing to do with social media. Social media was just a tool that facilitated the sharing of information amongst not just people in Africa, but people in Africa to the West, and then people reported about what was going on. I think another important thing to note is the number of people who have access to internet in Africa, generally speaking, isn't that high. And although places like Algeria and Morocco, it's a little bit higher, the numbers just don't justify the fact that it's being, this whole situation is being called a social media or Twitter revolution. It just doesn't add up. I think it's somewhat of a marketing ploy. And in many ways, I think it's also a way to make us think that, you know, without a tool, we can't revolt. I mean, it's somewhat belittling the cause of people. So I actually don't think, you know, personally, that this social media was responsible for the revolution. And then I guess the other thing I was wondering was, would this revolution happen if there was no Facebook and Twitter? And the answer, of course, is a yes. There was an article that was written by Malcolm Gladwell. He's a famous Canadian who lives in the U.S. He wrote an article for The New Yorker in October of 2010. And it's titled Annals of Innovation, Small Change, Why the Revolution Will Not Be Tweeted. And he gives an example of the Greenboro sit-ins, which was started by, it was in the summer of 1960, and it was started by university students who went and sat in a cafeteria and decided that they were not going to move. And this, the situation at that time was, there was all over the South, there was places where whites only could eat and where the black people would eat. So they decided that they were not going to be oppressed anymore and that they were going to go and sit and eat where the white people were. And they sat there, and it was a sit-in for a long time. And then the same thing happened throughout the South. And he talks about that took a lot of courage, and it was a very risky thing to do. And the difference is that because it's very risky, they put their lives on the line. And social media does not allow for that kind of risk-taking. It's just very passive, he argues, which I agree with for the most part. So he says that it's passive, and the revolutions actually need strong leadership. It's very strategic and systematic in the way things are done. And social media just doesn't provide that kind of condition for having a revolution. It's a tool like every other tool. For example, the television, radios, email, and all those sorts of things that allow us to be able to share and communicate. But it doesn't have the power to make the difference. It's people who make change, not tools.
Absolutely. And one interesting point that some people have been making is that also in the case of Egypt, at one point during the sitting that was taking place at Tahrir's place, the government have decided to shut down the whole infrastructure, internet infrastructure of the country. And it's around the time that we have witnessed a greater mobilization of the trade union movement, and that was the final days of the existence of the Mubarak regime. So at the critical point in time in the struggle to overthrow Mubarak from power, internet wasn't available at that time because the whole internet infrastructure was shut down by the government for a couple of days. But that did not prevent the process to deepen and also to go ahead and proceed in the struggle. But Carlson, how do you see, after those changes that happened in Tunisia and Egypt, do you still think that it's being still used as a critical tool in terms of communication between people who've been involved in those processes of toppling the regime in Tunisia and Egypt, or is it something that has kind of stopped after that first objective was achieved?
It's still going on, and I've been following Twitter, and I am also one of, I tweet myself, I look at what other people are saying about the situations, and I share, retweet what other people are saying. I'm guilty of that. And actually, that was one of the other things I wanted to talk about, is a lot of the noise and a lot of the conversation was actually happening with Westerners about the issue, about the revolutions that were happening in North Africa and in the Middle East. Most of the conversation is actually happening out here and not in the countries. A few people share whatever information they have, and then many people in the West are the ones who are resharing whatever comes out of there. So that's important to note, is a lot of the noise is actually happening amongst Westerners and not in Africa itself. I'm sorry, your question?
Well, we're going to take a short musical break, and when we come back, we're going to explore a little bit further into this situation. Just to the listeners, I'm in the studio with Carlson Abdi, who is a guerrilla member, and who have been thinking a little bit of the role, supposed role that news, social media have played in changing some of the dynamics in countries like in North Africa, in Egypt and Tunisia. Is it a real tool that have played a greater role, or is it just overblown? We have heard very interesting analysis from Carlson. So we'll take a short musical break and come back in a couple of minutes.
We live in a world that's filled with injustice, where people are oppressed and killed because they want to defend their land. We have to join together and fight against this, so that everybody has the right to live in freedom, and open up freely in society.
Welcome back to Amanla. You're listening to Amanla on CKLN. I'm not sure if I should say 88.1 FM because it's no longer on the air, but on CKLN. And I'm in the office today with Carlson Abdi, who is a guerrilla activist and member, very dynamic person from the African community in Toronto, who's been reflecting a lot around issues evolving social media, technologies, internet-based applications, how it's being used, and the pretension some people make that it has played a very critical role in the uprisings that took place in North Africa. Carlson seems to go against that current. And Carlson, how widespread the use of this social media is within the diasporic African community in Toronto? And that would be one of my first questions. And the second question would be, how are they using it? How do they use this tool? For what purposes?
Just generally speaking, I think social media is used pretty much by everybody. And in Canada now, people are pretty savvy, even if they came from the African continent or are considered of the diaspora. I think we're pretty much mainstream. It is widely used, and I can just say amongst myself and my friends, it's used. We use things like Twitter and Facebook. But the conditions in Canada are, generally speaking, are okay, you know, economically. However, there's organizations that are using it to mobilize young people to vote, for example, to get people engaged in issues that are happening within the community. It's also used for raising funds for organizations both in Canada and in developing countries. So it is still, it's very useful. I'm not diminishing the possibilities and also what it's doing for our community here and back home. It's amazing. It's revolutionized the way we live our lives and how we communicate with one another. But then again, I think it's important for me to reiterate again that it is a tool. It's a tool that allows us to share information, and that sort of thing. But it just doesn't. It does not. It cannot replace the face-to-face interaction that you and I can have, and the change that you and I are capable of doing together. And you know, it just doesn't replace that.
One quick example maybe is, let's say about political campaign for elections. How can it be used to mobilize the citizens in making sure that they vote for a particular candidate or something like that? How is used for someone who is not very familiar with this technology like me?
Well, a good example is Obama's campaign, and sadly I have to go back to that again, but he was very effective in getting young people and people within the community to know what his cause was and what his platform was, and he got people to donate to his cause, you know, small amounts, but small amounts from a whole bunch of people adds up. So he got a lot of support through social media, and he got his name out there because he was very strategic, and his campaign was, you know, online based, but not completely. I mean, he also, you know, went on the road and all that, but he was very successful. He's actually one of the case studies of having a very effective online campaign, political campaign.
So it looks like it's something that should be complementary to the other dimension of human interaction. Mm-hmm. That's completely taking it further. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Amanla, and as I mentioned earlier, this special edition is focusing exactly on African Liberation Day, and in Toronto, the African Pan-Africanist community will be celebrating the African Liberation Day today at 5 p.m. at different book lists, which is located at the corner of Brewer and Barters. You can check it out on the internet if you want the exact address. Unfortunately, I don't have it on my display, but it's called A Different Book List. And during that event, we're going to have a couple of panel discussions that will be reflecting on issues like neoliberalism and the attempt to militarize the African continent in order to secure access to the resources of this continent. And we'll have also another panel discussion and a presentation about social media and revolution. Carlson Abdi will be going much deeper into those topics this afternoon. So everybody is invited to come join us today to celebrate this special edition of African Liberation Day at 5 p.m. sharp at a different book list, which is located at 746 Barter Street. As I mentioned, it's at the corner of Bloor and Barter. So 746 Barter Street at a different book list at 5 p.m. All the Pan-Africanist and internationalist segment of the city are invited to come attend this special event. And it's going to be also an occasion to make some comments about an important declaration that was put out 2 days ago by Grilla on the condition of the African continent, which is a deep analysis of the major events that have been going on from the continent for the last couple of months, going from the situation in Ivory Coast, in the referendum in Sudan, the wave of revolts in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, the situation in the Indian Ocean around Somalia and all those kind of areas. So there's a very important declaration that was put out by Grilla to analyze all those events that you can find directly from the internet by going to the website grilla.org, grilla.org. And for any feedback, you can send us an email at admin@grilla.org. So that's all the time we had for today. And stay tuned for the rest of Saturday Morning Live. Thank you very much and have a good day.
together, like unto one lone ranger, funny child, my imagination running wild. I would lie for you, baby.
Come, let me take you back in time.
Give this thing resting on the mind.
And you're listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, and joining me on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn. How are you doing this morning?
Fine, and yourself?
Oh, I can't complain. I guess we have a number of issues to talk about, the G8, Syria, Libya, the IMF leadership, as well as that hot potato called Israel, but I guess we wanted to start off on a very sad note, the passing of Gil Scott Heron. I would like to get your thoughts on Gil Scott Heron. And did you ever meet him or see him live?
I saw him live. I have a memory of doing so. It's very sad that this man of 62 years born, or at least spent a good deal of his childhood in Tennessee and a good deal of his childhood in New York City, before attending school in Pennsylvania and catapulting into the front ranks of popular artists, passed away because of the inability of his body to handle an infection. It's well known that in his later years he had troubles battling drugs of various sorts, which is ironic since one of his signature songs was The Bottle, which was about another kind of substance abuse. I'm speaking of the problem of dealing with alcoholism. Of course, we all know his signature song, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Winter in America. We all know, of course, that he was a well-known poet, that he was a novelist, that in some ways he's considered the godfather, progenitor of rap. Obviously, extremely talented. And I think it makes all of us feel our mortality, the fact that he passes away at such a relatively youthful age.
It's kind of ironic that Gil Scott Heron has relatives right here in Toronto. His uncle Roy still lives here, and his cousin Melissa, I don't recall his other cousin's name, but his uncle Roy is 90 years old, still living here in Toronto, and big supporter of the NDP, one time was a member of the U.S. Communist Party, wants to go to China, still talks about, pardon me, going to China. And his father, Gil Scott Heron, Gil Heron, was a great soccer player, the Black Arrow, who played for Scotland. Gil has quite a resume. And there's one problem I always have to mention. His mother, Bobby Scott Heron, was really, I read somewhere where she was one of the most brilliant women in America. I know she was a librarian and as well as a singer. But someone sent me something a couple of years ago about how brilliant Gil's mother was. She died she passed in 1999. And Gil's father, I think he passed away maybe maybe 4 years ago. I know I wrote about that. You can Google Gil Scott Heron and my name, and that story is on the Pan-African Newswire.
Yeah, it's very tragic, very unfortunate.
The G8, what are your thoughts on that G8 situation? It looks like Harper and President Obama, Prime Minister Harper, and President Obama had a little side meeting. What are some of the main points of how do you, what are your thoughts on the G8 the meeting?
Well, the debate is basically Canada and the United States were the leading European countries, such as Italy, France, Britain, and Germany. And Russia, combined with Japan, had its annual meeting in France under the leadership of President Sarkozy. The headline coming out of this meeting, it seems to be that Russia has agreed to try to talk Mr. Gaddafi of Libya into going exile. It's quite unfortunate because Vladimir Putin, the Prime Minister of Russia, and perhaps the President, had condemned the NATO bombing of Libya quite justifiably and quite understandably. Mr. Dmitry Medvedev, the President, has been less caustic in his criticism of the NATO bombing, and of course, it was he who represented Russia at the G8 meeting in Libya. But I think perhaps the overriding headline out of the G8 meeting is what relative power has to say the G8 is in a process of rapid decline. It's well known that the group of 20, which includes the G8, in addition to the rising powers of China and India and Brazil, that is the go-to forum for grappling with pressing international problems. I mean, quite frankly, how can you have a group of eight so-called leading economies that does not include the number two power, economic power in the world? I'm speaking of China. And this is increasingly a problem in the world. That is to say that the forums of the world, and we're going to be speaking of the International Monetary Fund shortly, basically have been outstripped by the powers of the developing countries, which obviously is a misnomer since they've obviously developed China in the first place. So the G8, it seems to me, is headed for the ashabin of history. It's lost its relevance. It reminds me of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which even though it's bombing Libya, has also lost its relevance, and that there is a new world that is emerging and that has emerged. But what strikes me and what I think will strike future historians is how so many constituencies refuse to acknowledge this new world. And this is a question I have for you. One of the things that really concerns me going forward in the 21st century is how little black American intellectuals and leaders are taking cognizance of the rise of China, India, and Brazil. And I'm wondering, does the same hold true for black Canadian leaders and intellectuals?
Unfortunately, I would have to say yes. I was at a meeting last night about Egypt, the Egyptian revolution and the revolution in North Africa. And there were three people of African ancestry in the room. I know one sister was from Kenya. I know her. And another sister, I don't know where she was from. And I saw an Asian woman. She could have been Korean, Chinese, Japanese. You know, I can't look at people and tell where they're from. So she was Asian. And the rest of the people in there were Euros. And this was about Egypt, which is supposedly, last time I checked, Egypt and Libya still are in Africa. But I didn't see any of us. There was a speaker there from Egypt. And there may have been, I didn't see anyone. And I go to meetings like that all of the time. And when it comes to the international situation, I remember there was a meeting about Korea I went to a couple of months ago. And once again, there I was all by myself. It was a meeting about North Korea, so-called North Korea. And someone had slides. Of course, I was interested in that. And it's relatively sad. I have a friend of mine that I talk to all the time about those situations. And he is saying that the Africans, people, many of whom are immigrants, are that those are not bread and butter issues. So that's why they're not there. But I hate to say that, but that's the way it looks to me.
Well, it's different south of the border because the black population is largely not immigrant. They're largely descendants of those who were slaves, although certainly not exclusively. And I think the reasons here are more complex. I think it has to do with the fact that before approximately 50 years ago, the black population in the United States was probably one of the worst treated populations of any in the world. And then, with the rise of the Cold War, there was pressure in the United States to improve its human rights record, and the trade-off was that the United States demanded that the black population rid itself of intellectuals like W.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, Shirley Graham Du Bois, who had an internationalist posture. So this was part of the trade-off, although people don't want to acknowledge that trade-off because it's too painful to contemplate. And so since that time, there's been a sort of a shying away from rather tricky international questions. Of course, episodically, there's been condemnation of the war in Vietnam, for example, or the war in Iraq, but there's no consistent internationalism by and large. And you see this in particular, if I may be allowed to segue, with regard to the International Monetary Fund, which is the debt collector for the leading capitalist institutions worldwide, headquartered in Washington, D.C. And here is the story. We all know about how Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the socialist from France, was accused in recent days of attempting to rape a chambermaid in a hotel in Manhattan, and he was forced out. And now there is a search for a new leader of the IMF, and the Europeans are insisting that the post-World War II consensus alleged that made it necessary to hire a European in that prestigious and powerful position hold true, even though that, and if you look today, you have a situation where Brazil, which is one of the top 10 economies in the world, has the same voting power in the International Monetary Fund as Belgium, one of the smaller European nations and barely in the top 20 in terms of economies in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Brazil, Russia, India, and China are insisting that merit, and not just a geographical quota, that is to say you have to be European, a Western European at that, in order to hit the International Monetary Fund. It doesn't matter how competent a Canadian or an Australian or a South African or a Brazilian or a Chinese might be, this position must be held by a Western European. Now, you have the situation in the United States where the black American population has taken a real beating in recent years over alleged quotas in terms of positive discrimination or affirmative action for various positions in higher education and in the employment market, and how affirmative action and these alleged quotas supposedly override merit. And so you would think that when you have this rather blatant situation where the French in particular are demanding a quota that overrides merit to hit the International Monetary Fund, that the black Americans in particular would be at the front of the line denouncing this kind of double standard. But they've been silent, and it's a real head-scratcher. And it leads me to believe that future historians might very well conclude that there's sort of a phony war taking place in the United States, at least, and perhaps in Canada, with regard to the struggle against racism, insofar as you see many of our anti-racist leaders, so-called, don't use all the weapons at their disposal, such as pointing up the contradiction of the United States and Canada and France. Certainly France. The United States is playing a double game, and I would imagine Canada is too, with regard to whether a Western European should hit the IMF. But in any case, this idea that there should be a quota for European overriding merit leading the International Monetary Fund, and yet with regard to positive discrimination, affirmative action for poor black people, supposedly there has to be merit reigning, allegedly, in all circumstances. And it's something, quite frankly, that it's difficult for me to comprehend.
You mentioned the whole question of racism. I was reading this book by Buck Clayton, and he mentioned the fact that his one of the churches he grew up with, his father.
Norman, there's some feedback coming back.
I can hear that. I think it's in the, it's coming from the other room. Is it still there?
No. Okay.
And Buck Clayton talked about in his book how his Roy Wilkins's father used to be a preacher at a church he went to, and Roy Wilkins was one of the main people that pushed that line about racism being one of the people that were the reactionary leaders in America that badmouthed the whole international hookup with China and India when everybody else was the black movement. The progressive segment of the black movement was calling for unity with India, Africa, and China. Roy Wilkins was the main person talking about we needed to stay away from those type of people. You're listening to CKLN. Are you there, Gerald?
Yes, but you need to speak up.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Did you hear what I said about Roy Wilkins?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that in the United States, and to a certain degree, Canada, a decision was made to sign on to the agenda of the prevailing ruling elite. And I guess that looked like a good decision at the time it was made about a half century ago. But now we've entered a new world situation, a new international situation. You might have noted that Mr. Obama, when he spoke before London's parliament just a few days ago, he made a big to-do about reassuring the Londoners and the British that despite the rise of India and Brazil and China, that the North Atlantic still has relevance and still matters, and the bilateral relationship between Canada and the United States on the one hand and the North Atlantic nations on the other still has relevance. And this was striking because the fact that he had to say that indicates that there is doubt about whether the North Atlantic nations still have hegemony in light of the rise of India, Brazil, and China. But the other thing that struck me was that with regard to black people in North America, Mr. Obama is one of the few who has addressed the question of the rise of Brazil, India, and China and its significance. This is mind-boggling because the ruling elites all over the world are trying to figure out what this new world order may portend, and yet those who have the most to lose and the most to gain, I'm speaking of these black minorities, so-called, in North America, have been tongue-tied when it comes to addressing one of the most important issues of this early 21st century. It's really either a case of malfeasance and misfeasance on their part, or just some sort of fundamental misunderstanding of how the world works.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of many, many, many books. Did a great book on Du Bois. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
I wanted you to double up or triple up, really, and we wanted to talk about Israel, Libya, and Syria. You know, President Obama did a real thing with the leader of Netanyahu. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that Mr. Harper and Mr. Obama are in many ways doing a disservice to Israel, although I would probably isolate Mr. Harper more so than Mr. Obama, because he on this issue, he seems to be to the right of the U.S. administration. And I'm speaking of the fact that the Palestinians are going to the United Nations in a few months, basically requesting diplomatic recognition of the West Bank and Gaza as an independent Palestinian entity. It is expected that they will walk away with some form of recognition, and this may open up the possibility of further sanctions on the state of Israel. It has not been discussed, but I would not rule out the possibility that an independent Palestinian state with diplomatic recognition, like any independent state with diplomatic recognition, could call upon its allies to militarily expel an illegal occupation, that is to say, by Israel. It's difficult to say what kind of support Israel could get given such a circumstance. So obviously, Israel is headed over a cliff. What's striking, at least south of the border, is that the Democratic Party, the ruling party to a degree in Washington, is to the right of Mr. Obama on this particular question, because Mr. Obama was actually trying to prod Mr. Netanyahu, but yet he was undercut by his own party. And this is not unusual and something that is oftentimes lost sight of. Mr. Harper's position, as I understand it, is even worse than that of Mr. Obama in terms of being basically in handcuffs with Mr. Netanyahu in terms of Mr. Netanyahu's obstinate position that Jerusalem forevermore will be solely ruled by Israel, that there's no right of return for Palestinian refugees expelled illegally and unfairly from their residences over the past half century, and that there will be a military presence of Israel on Palestinian soil forevermore. Now, what is the response in Canada to Mr. Harper's positions on these very difficult and sensitive issues?
Well, first of all, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement started in Palestine, but it also went to having problems with this mic. Can you hear me?
Yes, it's a lot of crackling.
Well, this is the Ted Mack Amateur Hour. People not born in North America probably won't know what I'm talking about. We have a lot of people listening on the internet, but yeah, this is a Ted Mack Amateur. But I was saying, Harper is the people what started in Canada was the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, started in Palestine, and the first country outside of Palestine that it started in was Canada. So there is a huge opposition to Harper's shenanigans here in Canada, but it's not getting any traction because they won't put it in the papers. But you know, the universities have tried to stop the BDS movement from taking traction or having an impact on college campuses. They have been there's a mixed bag there. Some places we have it, and some places we don't. So it's I would say that the Harper is in power, which is very important, but there's great opposition to what he's trying to do, and people are calling him on the fact that he is to the right of Obama, to the right of Sarkozy. He's to the right of everybody. He's probably Israel's biggest partner right now in the world.
Mm. Well, this is also linked to the neighboring questions of Syria and Libya, and I know the time is expiring, so I'll be brief. I mean, basically what's happening is that Syria is under enormous pressure from the G8 in particular, but Syria is getting enormous support at the same time from Iran, from Hezbollah in Lebanon, where Sheikh Nasrallah gave a well-received speech in the past few days to thousands of his supporters in Beirut. And it should also be added that the Syrian question is connected to Hamas, which is now part of the ruling elite of the nation-state of Palestine. So that situation is going to be very difficult to shake out. Now, on the other hand, it did not get much attention that the African Union has basically demanded that NATO stop its bombing campaign against Libya. Mr. Zuma of South Africa, who sadly and tragically voted in favor of United Nations Resolution 1973 authorizing this bombing, or I should say providing a pretext for this bombing, since supposedly this was supposed to only call for a no-fly zone. He's on his way to Libya, probably there right now. Mr. Obama, and to me, it's probably the most shameful episode of his presidency, has now moved from calling for protection of civilians to regime change in Libya. Mm. And it's a very unfortunate and disgraceful turn in terms of the U.S. policy towards Libya. But the Libyan leadership is still hanging on, and it's unclear, as of today, what's going to happen with regard to that beleaguered North African nation.
This is the last question. What do you think about African American Appreciation Month? That's what Mr. Obama is referring to. Black Music Month has been liquidated. I guess it's too early. What's happening with Black Music Month? Or has there been any talk about it? Or is it a dead issue since African people in America are no longer black? They're urban people now. Is any talk about that?
If so, it's passed under the radar. Of course, June is not here for a few more days. Perhaps when June finally does arrive, we'll hear more about it.
All right, sir. So next week, we'll be back in touch with you.
Yes, take care.
All right. And we have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. We're going to listen to G.C. Cameron and something called Shadows.